Undecillion? That's after Giga?
Well, it's one of the biggest ones I've seen. It's tender. It's the one with 36-year-olds after it.
All right. Esther says we're live and well, so let's get rolling here. All right. Good morning, everyone. This is Commissioner Brian Colquhoun, 12-4 of the Capitol. Today, it is October 30th, 2013, for a work session on case number PU-12-813, NSP's 2013 electric rate increase application. We had one work session on this a while back, and this is our next one, so I don't have any particular opening comments, but I'd be happy if Randy or Julie, as a portfolio holder, has anything.
Well, I have spent a fair amount of time the last couple of weeks going back and reexamining the testimony, both by staff and our advocacy staff and the company, and feel like I have more specific thoughts on the issues that remain, the concerns, and looking forward to our discussion this morning to talk through some of these things.
Okay, ready?
No opening comments. Let's just get at it.
All right. I'll turn it back to you then, Julie. It's your portfolio.
Okay.
I'll follow your lead.
I think a good place to start, and I hope you all have it, is the October 4th filing from the company of late filed exhibits. This is a semi-complete collection of the late filed exhibits, and a few things still outstanding in here, but I think the area where I'd like to focus our discussion and walk through is exhibit 6 on this document. Do you guys have this? Yeah.
Comparison of staff and rate requirements?
Okay. Yeah, it's the position summary after North Dakota staff testimony, which was supplemented after the hearing. So it basically outlines on all the financials, where the company is, where the advocacy staff is, and kind of outlines the differences there. And I think it sort of collects in one location all the differences between the two positions, and really some big things jump out at you when you look at this in terms of the major areas of contention. And so if you guys are okay, I thought we'd just walk through some of these line by line here. The first section is, first of all, is that an okay approach?
Yeah.
Do you not have this?
I think I do. Which page are you on?
Exhibit O, last page.
I should say we're joined. Patrick Fawn and Jerry Leon are with us today from Commission staff.
Exhibit O.
He's got it. Everyone's got it. Okay, so the first chunk of that, so it starts with $16,900 as the beginning point, and then subtracts and adds from there. The corrections and updates on the first section there are all the same. Those have all been agreed upon by the company and advocacy. So I think we can skip down then to the assumptions and allocations, unless you have some.
Just a thought, Julie, is that I think your point is to find out where they disagree. But I would just say, just because the staff and company doesn't have any disagreements doesn't mean that.
True.
Just
fair
as long
enough.
I throw that out there that anybody listening, or even for the two of you, that doesn't mean that I'm going to agree with their pension update, let's say.
Correct.
But I think for what you're trying to do today, I think that's perfect, just as long as I put that out there.
Okay. So going down to our return on equity, the company is advocating for 10.25%. Advocacy staff is advocating for 9%. That results in a difference. Well, the company's position is $1.1 million lower than what they originally requested. And then the advocacy staff's position, if we went with 9% return on equity, would be a $5.2 million reduction in the revenue requirement. I don't know where my colleagues are on the ROE, but I am of the opinion that with the company's history on rate cases coming in, you know, last year, this year, talking about coming again perhaps next year. We're looking at maybe potentially having another rate increase on the heels of this one. That really detracts from the company's position that they need a higher ROE because interest rates are increasing. I think that we could reduce that ROE and still give time to adapt to rising interest rates because they probably aren't rising that fast. They'd be back in here for a rate increase and we can adjust it then. So that's kind of where I'm coming from on the return on equity. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts.
I would just, I guess, echo what I said maybe before, is that if there was some kind of assurance that we knew the company wasn't going to come back for 3 years, I'd be more likely to be 10% or higher. If there's no assurances on that, 9% would be probably as high as I would go. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of, I can go either way, but if they're going to be back every year, 9%. So that's kind of where I fall out now.
You know, when King was the advocacy staff's expert on this, and his arguments that in response to the company's assertions that it'd be hard to attract capital if the ROE isn't high enough, his response to that, saying that actually a lower ROE, if it decreases the stock price, is going to be appealing to investors who want to get in at a lower price. So it would actually attract. I think that, you know, it's a horse apiece. I think that that made sense to me. So any other thoughts, Randy, do you have on ROE?
I don't have anything specific in mind, but agree with the concepts that you two have mentioned. If it's longer term, I too would be more favorable toward something higher. I don't know if if there's no commitment to a time frame, and so we're expecting this to be back in a year or two. I don't know if 9 is necessarily the right number, but I do think, I mean, clearly the surrounding states, when they last had rate cases, were under 10, and it would sure, in my mind, need to be somewhere near that area.
Mm-hmm. The other issue that came up during the case that has resonated with me is this issue that I know the financial markets look at the allowable ROE, but the reality is the company hasn't really even come close to earning that return on equity, and I'd be interested in finding ways that we can help contribute to their success in achieving the ROE that they're allowed to achieve and help, you know, improve that. So I don't know that that is addressed by where we set it, but that's just something else that I'm thinking about and would like to make some progress towards. Okay. Then maybe we want to pop down to the demand allocator. This is another area that I've been digging into. I actually looked back on the I hope I have it here. Order. Shoot. Do you have it? Oh, good. Thank you. Good, good, good. I might have to break for 1 minute and go back and get the order that's at my desk.
Thanks.
I was, before I do that, they're at a 12 CP demand allocator. Staff advocated for a 1 CP and then sort of backed off a little bit on that, saying, not sure that the 1 CP is the right method, but 12 CP is clearly resulting in North Dakota bearing more share of the cost than they probably should. That's a concern for me. I think it's been proven in past rate cases with NSP, even dating back to 91 is the case that I wanted to highlight some information from, where staff really looked at this and proposed a different one for that very reason, that the 12CP places a larger share on North Dakota customers than might be appropriate. And so I'm very open to changing that. I think it's an important issue to look at. I understand that the company likes it because all the other jurisdictions use it, and it results in 100% recovery. I understand that's a priority, and we need to be sensitive to that. At the same time, I don't think it's right for decades for North Dakotans to be bearing an inappropriate share of the costs. So at some point, somebody needs to take the step to change that, and I'd like to look at that very closely in this case. What Jerry passed out is the...
Before we go into that, yep, graph, could you walk me through again, and maybe Pat and Jerry could help out. The case you're referring to, I read through those, and I can't remember exactly. Didn't it turn out where the commission picked one, and there was a change in commissioners, and then the new commission came in, and they went back to the other one?
Correct.
I mean, can you walk me through what was first? Did they go from 12 to 1, then back to 12, or did they go at 1 and then not hold 1? Because we ended up at 12. So it's like, if I remember right,
we started in that case with 12 when it was filed, and that had been adopted some years before that, as I recall, in another case before my time. Pat might know what they were at before that. Was it a peak and average?
That's what I recall.
Okay. and so I do remember there had been a pretty big effort to get to 12CP, and it was, they managed to get all of the states on 12CP. And then in that case that you mentioned, the commission changed it to a weighted 12CP, where they put more weight on the summer peak that they're building for, and less weight on the other peaks, and that changed the allocation, decreased North Dakota's share some.
So it wasn't a 1CP; it was a weighted 12CP.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then at that point, the commission changed, and there was a rehearing. And the new commission went back to the 12CP, on the regular 12CP on rehearing.
Okay, and so, Julie, you're thinking of more of a, not necessarily advocating so much for 1CP, but just something different than 12CP.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The weighted 12CP that they chose, basically, so if you do just the, if you do the 12CP, it suggests, from what I'm, and this is generalizing, but these are more art than science. So the 12CP suggests that you have a pretty flat demand curve, right, Pat? Is that your kind of understanding of the 12CP?
Put your mic on too, Pat, will you?
I think we even heard testimony at the hearing that if you have significantly varying peaks, it would tend to move you away from the 12CP method.
Mm-hmm. So if you look at the peak, look at their curves, I mean, they have clearly a peak. It's not one steady sort of demand curve. There's a very definite peak. And there's some other, you know, shoulders in there as well. So the weighted 12 basically looks at some of those other peaks and factors them into the formula as well. Correct?
It would give greater weight to a larger or higher peak. It would be a move away from the 12CP by giving greater weight to the highest peaks.
Mm-hmm.
Relatively greater weight.
Can you sort of talk through, Pat, how that might account for North Dakota's load curve, demand curve? or how that might better reflect what's happening here as it pertains to the system as a whole. Because some things about our contribution to this, their system, suggests that, you know, the fact that we're peaking, we have a pretty higher peak in December in the winter. It's not maybe the peak, but it's higher. And that's not being reflected in the current way that the costs are allocated, but it might be better in the weighted CP.
Well, I wish the scale on these two graphs was the same. I think it would be a lot more dramatic.
Next page.
It would be a more dramatic picture for, like, a picture is worth 1,000 words, but
right.
Or 10,000 words, whatever. But it would be much more dramatic. You'd see, of course, you'd see that the North Dakota portion of the total peaks in any month is a small portion.
Mm-hmm.
But you would also see the peaks varying less significantly, I think, than the total system.
Because ours part is so small of the system.
Yep.
During their low periods of January and February, December, their winter time, we almost peak in the winter. It looks almost like we have two peaks, a winter and a summer peak. And so I think our winter peak helps to smooth out their load curve a little bit. And that's, and we're, you know, if we're paying more to help their load curve, that doesn't make sense.
Do you gentlemen know why the commission did the weighted 12 CP, why they went back to it? What the rationale was getting away from it? And I'm sure I could read what I could, but when I read through it, it didn't jump out. It just, they did it.
Yeah. I think that the result of that changing to the weighted 12 CP and some other things ended up with less of an increase than the new commission wanted to give them.
Fair enough.
And
so it was so more of an end game of a number than more than anything. Okay.
I think in a way it was, but I don't, you know, that wasn't all. I can't
but
say exactly
could we,
what their choice.
Using the logic that one of you said about the fact that North Dakota is such a small part of XL's system, that let's say we went weighted 12 CP with this case, that doesn't mean we need to go weighted 12 CP with MDU or Otter Tail. There'd be different percentages. It'd be a whole different formula, wouldn't
Otter
it?
Otter Tail's on a 1 CP.
Exactly. But for MDU, aren't they on a
12? I believe.
Each company would has a different load profile.
Right.
I think
that's
MDU's on 12.
Okay.
I can't say that for sure, but
I don't mind doing things differently, just unless there's a good reason. But I think that's trying to set up that if we do go this way, what the reasoning is. So.
Right. Well, the reason would be, in my opinion, a more accurate reflection of the costs, North Dakotans' contribution to the costs. And that's the whole goal of these rate cases, is doing that accurately.
Yeah,
right?
Your reasons can be different for different companies, I think. Okay. Depending on their load curves and so forth, too.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So just in a general thought, Julie, as we proceed forward, we've got all these issues that we're working through. Should we have staff working on a draft order right now? Because that's what I'm kind of thinking is, as we're not making any final decisions, of course, here, but start giving staff the opportunity to start plowing forward with an order here.
We were hoping for a proposed order to start with, so it would be best if we could wait for that and then start working on a draft order off of that. I'm not sure what the part
of I don't know that you're going to get a proposed order from anybody. They've had the opportunity for 2 months to do a proposed order. So I guess we have the hearing tomorrow and the next day on the wind farm. And then we've got the gas ones coming up, and I've already put the letter in there that I want to include all that together. But mm-hmm. I think we should be looking for putting together some kind of order here now. That if you want to wait a little bit longer, I don't have a problem with that. But
I looking at my own workload, hoping to wait a little while longer.
Well, I guess if the company doesn't provide a proposal, we should get going on a draft, and maybe we, you know, look at that after we complete the hearings this week, and maybe start plowing through each of those categories and just coming up with some language for starters, at least.
So, were you done on that as far as the draft order?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, is your thought then, if we are to change, that a weighted 12 CP would be the best alternative as opposed to 1 or 4 or 6 or anything else?
I'm not completely sure the differences between the weighted 12 and the 4. They seem sort of similar to me, but maybe I'm all off base on that. Any thoughts, Pat or Jerry?
The 12 CP is premised on saying that every month has a contribution to the system's requirements, and it should be figured in there somehow or other. Well, they get the 12 CP gives them an equal consideration. If you weight it, you're saying that the summer peak is what you're building for, and there's a more influence on the cost. It has more influence on your total costs than the other months do. And so that's kind of the difference there. The other are variations of those.
But don't you weight? You can weight the other peaks, so too, not just one. You can weight all
the
idea,
peaks,
you know, or maybe pick 4. Or I think they used 4.
A value to each peak. And
yeah.
And so they would all add up to 1.
So how would that be different than the 4 CP? That's 4, isn't that?
I think the 4 CP is going to take 4 peaks.
Yeah.
And give them equal weighting. But, you know, by the same concept, there's nothing that would stop you from doing a weighted 4 CP.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's...
Well, I have more research to do before I settle in on exactly which one I think is best. The previous commission did a fair amount of work on the weighted 12 and had some pretty good rationale for it. And so that's a logical starting point.
Okay, so that brings me to my question then. So if we were to choose a weighted 12 CP, would we want to have that in effect as soon as this rate case goes into effect? Or at some time certain, a little bit down the road, where it makes a switch, so which would give the company some time to figure out how to juggle the numbers so it totals close to a total amount of their costs. And also, I don't know if other states have shied away from doing anything but 12 CP because, well, the company wants everybody to be on the same track. And if they seen that North Dakota is switching, maybe some others would want to do that too. And so I just throw it out as a question. Do we want it immediately or at a future time certain?
Well, considering the fact that they're probably coming in here for a rate case again in the next 12 months, I don't know how far out would you put it, 6 months? I don't know. I think you'd have to make it as part of the terms of this.
Effective such and such a date that it switches or whatever.
In the last case, they just said file it, revise your calculations and file it.
Right.
Could we come up with a number that?
So it would be for this one.
Okay.
Of what a weighted 12 CP would mean? Like this graph here says 1 CP it shows, and then it shows 12 CP a difference of 20 million.
We don't have that number.
No, we don't have that.
But how do
that's a big calculation.
You'd have to go back in and calculate the new factor, demand distribution factor, and then you'd have to apply that to the various categories of expenses, rate base and expense.
It's not too hard to do like a 12 CP based on using the numbers that we have here, because you can see the highest peak in each month and each state's contribution to it, and you can calculate it. But when you weight them, you have to determine what you're going to use for weighting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so we wouldn't. That would be another decision the commission would have to make on what they would use for weighting factor.
So we can almost, the dollar amount, like in this case going to one was 20, we can almost pick our number there and then choose a weighting factor that reaches it.
We should have some or kind of a logical reason for picking the weighting the factor.
Yeah, I think you pick the factor that you think makes the most sense, and then the number comes out as it comes out.
Yeah, and I would recommend looking back and see what, starting with what they did before.
Yeah.
Okay, then, so how do we do that? Because that seems like that's going to be, as you look at these numbers, that's going to become central to this whole rate case.
In their order, in the when they did that?
No,
they said that they didn't actually have that in the order even. They just said the company will have to put this through their accounting system formula and the revenue requirement will adjust accordingly.
But it would be less than the $20 million difference here. Is that a fair assumption?
I think it's fair. Mm-hmm. Just intuitively looking at the data and thinking about the situation, I think that the single peak is probably the most favorable to our allocation.
I mean, just make sure I'm reading this correctly, but let's just suppose that we all agreed that we're going to go with the 12 CP. That shows a reduction of $20 million. They're asking for a rate increase of $17 million, so they'd be coming in for a rate increase. We change the 12 CP. They're actually going to have $3 million less than they started out asking for.
No, we'd be changing to the 1 CP. This suggests changing to the 1 CP. They're at 12 CP.
Oh, I'm
right
sorry.
Now.
Yeah, if we went to the 1 CP, they actually would be getting $3 million less than.
They'd owe us money.
Yeah.
They'd owe the ratepayers money.
Yeah.
All right. But I mean, that's how big
that's
it is.
How huge
that's
it
how
is.
Big of an issue
it's
it is.
Yeah, it's a big issue.
Yeah. And it's a big issue for them, too, because that's money that they're counting on capturing, getting from North Dakota ratepayers and probably not getting from Minnesota and South Dakota.
Yes.
So I recognize this is a big issue for the company.
But how do we, so you're saying we, and I get the logic, I think, is we would, let's say, figure out the weight, and then we'd say, okay, this is what we will approve, but we'd never actually know the number until they'd have a chance to calculate it. That seems like we'd want to know that number. I'd want to know that number before I ever voted on something. Just to say, okay, we approve this, but we don't know what the impact is until a couple months down the road. That just doesn't seem right. We should be able to have them run that back through. If we determine a methodology and have the company run it back through and give us what that number would be before we'd ever vote on it.
I wonder if there's a way to, if you wanted to make the change, to ask the parties and they can both run it through and send back what they think the effect of it is. We have what the advocacy staff's effect is on one CP.
Right.
They could redo their calculations, I would think. Do you agree with that, Pat?
Well, even if you hadn't figured out the exact allocator that you wanted to use, I think you could have the company run some what-ifs. What if the demand allocator was to change by such and such amount? What would be the impact on the revenue requirement? I think they could do a couple runs like that to give you an idea of what the impact would be.
See, I think you almost, I would almost have to have those numbers to compare before we do. You can't just say, we're going to prove this and then run it through the rate structure.
Right. Yeah, that's, well, I could be mistaken, but reading the order, that's what they seem to have done the last.
Well, another thing, like, what, do you know what, I haven't looked at this, but what was the demand allocator for the 12 CP? For North Dakota.
I have to get it here.
And then what was it for a 1 CP? Is that in the record?
Wait a minute. It might be on the last page here.
Well, I'm...
So if it was here, and then with 1 CP it was here, and that amounted to this change, $20,371,000. You could get an idea of, if it changes by a fourth of that. That's maybe a fourth of the impact.
The number was in the 6% range.
Maybe we have it already. Maybe we can.
We have it in another exhibit. I have to dig for it, though.
Well, I think that's something we're going to have to find, though. I like the concept, but we got to find what the impact is going to be.
Fair enough.
All right. So we'll work on that. Do you want to? How does this usually work, Brian? When issues come up during the work session that staff is following up on, do we have another work session? Do they get the information out to us individually?
Usually they would do whatever we'd ask them to do, but something this big, I'd say get the information and just give it back to us the next work session. Maybe if you want it individually as a portfolio holder,
sure.
So you can have a thought before it comes into here.
We'll provide it to all. At the same time we provide it to one commissioner, we'd provide it to all.
Okay, but so let's do that, and we can talk again and work through it at the next.
We'll see if I can figure out something.
Okay.
That's usually what happens. Jerry says he can figure out something.
Yeah. All right. Anything else on that? Okay, so this three-year average of revenues and expenses, that's a number. It's somewhat confusing. But that was the whole discussion with Mr. Mugrache, because he was questioning the company's estimations and used a three-year average of revenues and expenses versus their test year, solely their test year. And this is when he was saying that they hadn't tested their assumptions enough. But his numbers, I guess, ended up with an increase of the revenue requirement of $1.3 million. So that one's a little confusing. In my opinion, I'm more focused on the ROE and the demand allocator. Yeah. Then the amortizations, nuclear outage and the amortizations, those are another $30,000 and $239,000 adjustment that the advocacy staff made. I don't have any additional thoughts on those.
I think for me, Julie, is that these are all important numbers, but we get through the big bites first, and then, like you said, the rest of those might kind of shake themselves out. I'm looking back at my list of the items that I thought were big to this list over here. The one where it talks about charitable contributions, that's one that jumps out as me, is that I'm not for the charitable contributions to ratepayer dollars. Of the ones that are on the rest of the sheet, that's the one that jumps out at me the most.
I agree on that. And the economic development, I think are things that the company can do
with its
shareholder dollars. The charitable contributions are great. I'm glad the company does it, but it doesn't really directly impact their ability to provide reliable power and to the customers. And what if the customers don't agree with one of the charities they're giving with? They have no way out. So
I get the question all the time, is that the Excel Center, why is that paid for with ratepayer dollars? Well, it's not. It's paid for with shareholder dollars.
Yeah.
But it says Excel on it. So if Excel Corporation wants to give out money to charities and then take it out of the shareholder, I think I agree with you. I think
I agree as well.
So those two, I think, those I would say that the economic development. Do we need to flush out more on the economic development? That one, not quite as clear cut with how they defined economic development.
We have to go back and look at the list again.
But it's the same thought process, so why would you use ratepayer dollars for that?
And I think the logic is that there has been in the past that, according to staff, that some of the economic development investments in the small towns helped grow businesses, which helps, keep your customer base strong and that helps the company as a whole, which helps the ratepayers as well. So, but I think with the growth in North Dakota, I don't see that as being as big of an issue anymore.
Well, and I mean, if we were to take it under consideration, we don't have the information yet anyway.
Oh, that's right.
They were going to gather that, and that was Exhibit C on here, and that's one of the ones that they said they need additional time to prepare.
Oh, good.
So I'm sure not convinced at this point yet.
Yeah, why did the rest of these come through so quick but not that one?
Well, there's a few others that also aren't done. But
okay.
So, I mean, at this point, until something comes through that persuades me otherwise, I think that the charitable contributions and the economic development ones kind of fall in the same boat.
The one other big one, if you don't mind jumping back up to...
Sure.
Well, sorry, are we done with the economic development charitable contributions in that CAT section?
Sure.
Back up to capital/plant related. The final one in there, depreciation study, remaining life study, there was a fair amount of discussion of that during the hearing. And that was the legal versus non-legal AROs. And Pat asked the question in the hearing, and I don't know that we've gotten information back from the company yet or not, but he asked for confirmation from the company that they consider all of their property as a legal, basically as a legal ARO, or consider that they have a legal responsibility to remove that, which would then justify them depreciating those over, you know, collecting money from ratepayers and depreciating those over the cost of their life on the front end. If they don't view that, then I think this $1.1 million reduction has some merit into looking into that. But they seem to indicate in the hearing that they intend to remove these structures when they've you know, exhausted their life. And so then I would agree that they need to be able to recover the cost of doing so from the people who are benefiting from them in the first place, not after the fact. How they're accounting for that in their accounting system is interesting and kind of challenging to figure out. At one point, we questioned whether, in the instance of poles, they're charging customers for the removal of those during their life, but then when they're replacing the poles, are they basically covering that cost in the replacement as well? And I don't know, how do we figure out if that's happening, Jerry?
I don't know. What we had in the record was Majoris saying that when they replace a pole, they have a work order to go replace it. And that work order includes removing the existing pole. So the whole job gets charged to that replacement of the pole, and the job gets capitalized into rate base. And what Majoris was saying, that if they're already collecting depreciation, the salvage value out of the depreciation was negative, so that they're already collecting over the life of the pole the money to remove it, and then they turn around and charge that money into the installation of the new pole, and it gets capitalized going forward for another 40 years. They're in effect collecting twice, and then they're going to get the same depreciation on the capitalized portion, you know, with the negative salvage value again on the new pole, and then it just goes on. And so there's nothing in the record that rebuts that. So I don't know if that means you assume that it's true.
Yeah. So I guess for me, hearing from the company on whether they consider having a legal obligation to remove all of their property would help clear up some of this depreciation issue.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Because that one, I agree with you. It just seems like they're double dipping, unless someone tells me different. So, okay.
And I think those are two separate.
Yeah, that wouldn't really get to the double dipping. I think we have to. I don't know how to get to that. I think that's maybe an issue for a future exploration. But at least from the standpoint of getting a commitment from the company that yes, they are going to remove all these, and so it is appropriate for them to be collecting that money on the front end.
I think that we haven't gotten briefs yet either. Maybe there's something in briefs.
Okay.
Well, and Alana's out too, and she would add some discussion to this too, I'm sure. So.
Okay.
Is there more research that could be done into the transcript and record to try to figure that out?
We can dig. I just don't remember anything further on it being said, but. If it did, it would have came from Lisa's, what was her name, Lisa, so.
Forkett.
Yeah, it would probably, so we can look in there and see if we can find something, too.
Okay. Let's see. Then the cost of capital is another big one. And the numbers on this chart are somewhat confusing to me. Have you guys had a chance to look into those? If I'm remembering correctly, the cost of capital was how much they're charging ratepayers for the issuing of debt. Is that correct?
I kind of remember something like that, but I can't remember what it was. But there's some issuances. There's some cost for issuancing, and usually you allow them to recover those in the cost of capital rate.
Well, that's one I'll have to dig back into the testimony again and sort of figure out where those numbers are coming from. And then... otherwise, those are kind of the big issues for me.
Staff's number was positive on that cost of capital. That's what was.
That's why it's
weird about it.
Confusing. Hmm. You know, I know that there was a lot of talk on the incentive compensation plan. I tend to support the company's approach on that. If they want to use a good chunk of their salary dollars for incentive versus base salary, I don't feel like I need to tell them where to use it as long as their overall salary and expenses are not out of line, and I haven't seen any evidence that they are. So
that one, I had a note, Julie, that I don't disagree with what you said. I'm just not sure yet. There was a Wisconsin order that we were going to dig out the Wisconsin order to look through that one on them, and then there was a pending Minnesota decision that I just wanted to read through those.
Okay, and I'll note that.
I think the Minnesota decision has been finalized. I think I saw some news about that the other day. So we can maybe take official notice of those two and then kind of read through just to see what – obviously we'll make our own decision, but it would be nice to see how that played out in those two orders.
Okay.
Just so Randy and Julie know too, I have a 9:30 phone call I have to be on, but that doesn't mean you guys can't keep.
No, I need to actually wrap up by 9:30 as well.
Okay, perfect then.
Okay.
So what do we have left here? The 12CP, Jerry, I had a note here, transmission cost recovery rider, 12CP versus 1CP. Does that apply to transmission recovery rider too? And are those numbers included in the demand allocator? They wouldn't be, right? They're different. Where is that included in this spreadsheet?
I don't know when I think about it. The transmission costs would have to be divided amongst the jurisdictions as well, I think. But we had a straight kilowatt-hour charge, I think, proposed on the demand.
All right, I'll talk to you offline on that then, Jerry, unless, because I had a question on that. Matters. Sir.
You know, we've pretty well touched on all the big ones that I wanted to discuss, but a couple of other small ones. You know, we mentioned the charitable and economic development issues that have not been provided yet. Another one that I don't know how big of an impact it has and what all areas of all this, but Exhibit P, as in Paul, was supposed to be a chronology of Minnesota legislative mandates and the associated regulatory actions. That's not in yet either, and I don't know how much of an impact those might be having in various lines on here. So I'd be concerned about a settlement being reached and we just never get that.
Oh,
so I very much would like to see that.
What was that, Randy? I'm sorry.
The Exhibit P is in Paul, the chronology of Minnesota legislative mandates and associated regulatory actions.
Okay.
And Julie touched on it earlier, but then I thought we were going to come back to it a little more as far as the pension plans. You know, I guess I'm not sure exactly how this fits in. As we got assurance during the hearing that no money would ever be allowed to be taken from the pension fund to use for other corporate activities. But that's not what I'm worried about. I'm worried about when do either ratepayers or investors have to put money into the pension plan. If you look at Exhibit M, as in Mary, just based on these numbers, this thing is like pension plans we read about across the country that's, you know, ready to run in the ditch. You know, there's expected returns of anywhere from 7.25% to 9%, and over these years, it's been coming in around 5%. Now, a lot of that's because of the one big bad year, and I know that people tend to always, oh, well, it was just one bad year, but that's what you get when you continually plan on a pretty large return, and so you take chances and you get close to that, but when you're taking chances is when you get the real bad year. So I need to know whether eventually ratepayers are going to end up bailing this thing out, because this is not looking good.
Well, the answer would be yes. I mean, if they keep being negative projections, you'd sometime have to true it back up with a mix of ratepayer shareholder dollars. So how do we ask that question or clarify that a little bit?
Well,
you're pointing out the...
Can we not get something into the final outcome here that restricts that bailing out the pension fund is a responsibility of the investors and not the ratepayers? In the same way that the company can't use pension fund money for something else.
Well, we can put whatever we want in the order, subject to good legal review and staff review, and then we'll go from there, but I'm not against that.
I guess I'd at least like it explored or an explanation of why I shouldn't be worried about it.
It's a really tough, complicated subject. And something that I think you almost need a consultant to look at.
Okay.
So thinking out loud, it might be a thing that you want to look at with more detail in the next rate case.
We started out in that in the MDU rate case, and then we never really closed the loop on that one too tight. We did, but we moved through
it. It's a hard subject to get your arms around.
But you could put goalposts around some of the things that limit ratepayer exposure.
We could put Josh on it.
Let's just table that one for this one. Key that up. Is that okay with you, Randy?
For this today. Work session, yeah.
But put that as a big issue.
I put a note in here on it. And
so this is not incentive compensation. This is pensions. I have this. Okay. I put down MDU plan. You're telling us, so Jerry, it goes back to what do we have in the record around pensions and discussions which would guide us in going forward.
Yeah. And
I see. Okay. What else are you thinking, Randy?
That kind of completes my list.
Okay. Julie, do you have any other things for today that you want to covered a lot of ground, actually, today. Good work going through all
that
stuff.
We didn't talk much about the transmission cost rider.
No, I'll talk with Jerry more and try to get some more thoughts on that.
And I'm looking at the filing itself, but, you still have a question.
I think my discussion was how do we change?
I'm sorry.
Oh, I guess now that it jumps back in my head. I was concerned about if MISO policies change and the rider changes, that you wouldn't have Excel in there lobbying a certain way to change transmission riders, and then it comes back to us. And that was, I guess, now that I think about it, what I was trying to figure out how to put some constraints on that.
I think if MISO changes its ways, that it'll do it on a going-forward basis. And the projects that have been approved under the existing thing will continue to be allocated like they are.
Okay.
There's commitments made on those. And so I think that the MVP projects, for instance, that they've approved already are going to stay. And that is a major part of it.
Okay.
We'll stay in the cost sharing.
Well, just from a high level on the transmission rider, other companies have them, so it's not that we haven't done it before.
All agreed. Yeah.
If we approving a transmission cost recovery rider would lend itself to not infrequent rate cases. So if we could have assurance that they weren't going to be coming back soon, then I'd be more apt to go with one, because then they can it would work more effectively under those terms. Otherwise, why wouldn't we just take the cost for the test year and allow the company to recover them, and then do the same the next time we have a rate case and deal with it, because then you're dealing with the actual cost for that year. So I get concerned when it's okay, you've got a rate increase, 8% rate increase, plus you have a fuel cost rider, plus you have a transmission cost rider. There's all of these ways to sort of siphon off additional costs so the ratepayers end up not realizing they're getting a 10% increase or a 12% increase or whatever. So that's, where I'm thinking on the rider.
And I got confused for a minute. I'm looking at Otter Tail's MDUs outside of this. The NSPs hasn't been filed yet.
Okay, well, we'll sort through that. The last thing I had is just a quick question. I asked you guys formally, but I put that letter into the record about including all the information that we get from the wind farm, and we also get from the proposed gas plant to be able to use that information in this rate case decision. So if you have any problems with that, I'll ask tomorrow during the hearing as well, but I don't just... conceptually, do you guys think you'll have any problem with me trying to do that? This is speaking for me. That's the point of putting this in on the record, so that the companies, I think, will be able to object to it tomorrow if they want, and we'll hear from them tomorrow. But if they do, then that's their right. But I would intend to.
So what are you saying with this?
What I'm saying is that information I receive tomorrow about the importance of those wind farms, I can use in a decision about this rate case as it may relate to this wind farm. The information they get from the hearings in the gas plant, I can use during the rate case as well, because I think they're all intricately related. They're going to be talking about demand. They're going to be talking about what they need and how they make decisions. I just think it'll be...
Remember, you have some other wind farms, too.
That are in the rate
existing case. Existing, that are in this rate case.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to link them, because you've got existing ones in the rate case that are at issue.
Yeah.
And you've got these wind farm hearings are asking for ADPs or... forget who the PCNNs. And you've got the gas, which is has to be tied to their need for energy. So I just don't see how they cannot all be related. So that's what I'm thinking, I guess.
It seems to me like a very logical jump. I just think it almost should go without saying, but I understand why it needs to be said.
I think the proposed ones would be out of the test year. They'd be looking forward in that, and then they're recovering those costs through fuel cost adjustments.
Right, and that's the issue at the one in the rate case. But anyway, all right. So let's see. It is 9:27.
Does this case affect the fuel cost adjustment? Do we change anything in that in this rate case?
You can.
Okay.
No, that's a central point of issue. I think that how we decided what we're going to do with that.
You know, staff recommended that those wind farms not be in the fuel cost adjustment anymore. So that's an issue here.
So we've spelled out what will be included in the fuel cost adjustment in this rate case.
Yeah, if you told them to remove those wind farms from the fuel cost adjustment in this rate case, that would be an issue in this case.
Is the list of where do we see what's included in the fuel cost adjustment now? The whole list. I mean, if we're talking about excluding something.
We have the calculations from the fuel cost adjustment. And it lists by FERC account what the balances are, but we'd have to get further detail to know what each of the details of those FERC account numbers are.
But it's a big issue, though, because my thought on getting off track, but it's a good discussion to start off for the next work session, was the fuel cost rider was designed for fluctuations in gas cost, not so much to go out and buy wind and then flow it through fuel cost.
Right.
That's the way I look at that. So, but it had to be a philosophical change on how we approach the fuel cost rider.
Yeah, it was an energy cost thing.
Yeah.
And wind energy is energy. So.
Yeah. See, I can see that.
Good job lobbying. Wind.
If you want to see the current definitions for the fuel cost.
Yeah, we don't let demand costs in there.
Right.
Yeah.
But we let energy costs in.
So, how do you separate the demand costs from the energy costs on wind?
They're always separate.
But everything is demand on wind because there's no fuel.
A demand cost is a capital cost more that you're paying for your plant, and an energy cost is the cost to run the plant. Kind of generally, you think of it that way. If your energy costs vary with how long the plant runs, how much fuel you use. And your capital costs vary with the size of the plant that you build. How big, how much demand you had on how big did it have to be?
So only the energy costs of wind are funneled through the fuel cost rider?
There's really no capacity with the wind, but they do get some recognition from it in MISO. Like 15% or something of their rate nameplate capacity is recommended. Mm-hmm. But generally all of the contracts and everything that is thought of just with wind as a kilowatt hour, not a kilowatt transaction. And so it's been going through the fuel cost adjustment. I don't think there's any capacity payments being made anywhere on it.
Okay, I'm not sure that gets to what I was asking. I was wondering the capacity. Okay, so when a company runs their power purchase agreement for a wind project through a fuel cost rider, are they not in that power purchase agreement paying for the capital costs of that wind farm too?
Yeah, there's no energy costs with a wind farm. And so they take their initial installation charge and spread it out over the kilowatt hours that they are expecting to produce from it. And so with wind, your capital costs really become energy costs.
Right. Okay. Because the fuel is wind, it's basically free. But you could just they could just theoretically not pay for the wind farm capital costs, the towers, the turbines, the construction, and just the operation.
If they bought a wind farm and installed it, they could capitalize the whole thing and it would go into rate base, and they'd pay depreciation on it, or get depreciation on it, and then there would be no wind charges, no energy charges for it. I don't know that they've done that. You probably have to look, see, but I'm thinking of it as a power purchase agreement where they're purchasing energy from somebody else. They're not involving capital costs.
So you're just paying, in your theory, then you're just paying for the energy.
Yeah, that's, and we got different things going on, like the renewable energy rider with Otter Tail, where they're taking those capital costs and spreading them over kilowatt hours and that thing for the plants that they own.
Okay, well.
Anything else?
I don't have anything else.
Okay, work session's closed.
Thanks.
Thank you,